So the next talk is superficially quite similar in that it's also trying to model different aspects of regions or clusters of activation and how they interact with each other across space and across subjects. So we've got Tim Johnson from Michigan to talk about his research. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks. So between Du Bois's talk and Steve's segue a minute ago, so Du Bois called it a Bayesian spatial hierarchical model. Mine's a lot different. It's a Bayesian hierarchical spatial model. All right, so that's about the main difference. No, can everybody hear me here? Is this coming through? And then we had an awesome moderator here whose last question to Du Bois was about inter-subject variability. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today, is modeling this inter-subject variability. The variability could be due to slightly different regions in the brain that are activated between individuals, or the fact that you have this imperfect misalignment when you do the registration onto these templates. Okay, so the outline of my talk, excuse me, I'm going to give a motivating example first. And then there's a few statistical ideas I'd like to just give a little bit of a didactic introduction to that some people may not be familiar with. Then I'm going to give a quick overview of the model and the different hierarchies in the model. Then I'll go into the model details and give all the different distributions and prior distributions. Show some resulting estimation images, and then a little bit of concluding remarks. Is it? No. Okay. Thanks, Tom. Okay, so the motivating example, it comes from a study of proactive interference resolution. And what proactive interference is, it's this phenomenon that information that you recently learned gets mixed up with previously learned similar information. Okay, so as an example, Du Bois's talk is hierarchical spatial modeling. So as I'm going through my model, you may get mixed up between his model and my model. Okay, that's proactive interference. One's ability to resolve this proactive interference is key in determining how much information one can store in short-term memory. In the study, they studied 21 right-handed subjects that participated in the study. There was part of it was a visual task too, so all the people had 20/20 or correctable to 20/20 vision. We analyzed in this analysis data from 18 of the subjects, because 3 had severe spiral artifacts. So we just threw them out and didn't want to deal with those. In the original paper, among studying proactive interference resolution, they studied a few other things also, but it appeared last year in Neuroimages by Derek Nee, John Janides, and Berman. Okay, so the experimental paradigm in this study was called the recent probes task. And so it was an event-related study. For 2 seconds, a subject was shown a sequence of 6 letters, followed by a 3-second retention period. And then they were given a probe letter, P. And they had to, if P was in the current sequence of letters of the target probe, they did a left index button push. If it wasn't, it was a right index button push. Then they had a 5-second inter-trial interval. They were presented with another sequence of 6 letters for 2 seconds, 3-second retention period. Then they had 2 seconds to decide whether or not the probe letter S was in the most recent sequence, or if it was in the previous one. And this was recent non-negative because it wasn't in the recent sequence, recent negative, but it was in a previous sequence. A non-recent negative would mean that it's not in the current target or any previous targets. Recent positive is that it's both in the current target and in the past target. And non-recent positive is the letters in the most recent sequence, and it's not in the previous sequence. Okay, so this was done over and over again. And we all show slower reaction time and increased error rates when rejecting recent negative probes compared to non-recent negative probes. Okay, so it takes us longer to distinguish whether or not this particular letter was in the current target or if it was in the sequence previously, because you got, which one was it in? Was it in the one before or the one previous? So it takes a little longer to react to these things. And as a marker of proactive interference, this performance decrease is considered a marker of the interference. And the region that they're most interested in that's been linked to proactive interference resolution is the left lateral prefrontal cortex, at least for right-handed subjects. For left-handed, it may be in the right lateral prefrontal cortex. Okay, so here I'm showing four axial slices all at the same level, at the prefrontal cortex level, for just four of the 18 subjects we analyzed. And these are the bold statistic images from each subject. Like Du Bois, we don't want to pre-smooth the data, so the data hasn't been smoothed at all. And you can see some subjects show very little, if any, activation in the region of interest. Subject 15 and 4, it looks like the regions are quite different. This looks like it's more posterior, a little bit more medial than this guy here. And this subject shows, you know, some variability in the location also. Okay. If we do a mass univariate approach to this and combine all 18 subjects in the classical T image, you can see the highest region of activation is in this left lateral prefrontal cortex. However, when we ran three different thresholding methods for the mass univariate approach, we found nothing statistically significant. Okay? The random field threshold was 22.82, very conservative because of the low degrees of freedom. The Bonferroni threshold was 7.81, and I think the maximum value of the any statistic was just over 7. And if we control the false discovery rate at the 0.05 level, the minimum p-value is 0.24. Okay? And they found similar results. This is unsmoothed here, but when they smoothed the data, they found similar results. They really couldn't find anything significant, at least looking at this particular image, or the whole brain. Okay. So now let's move on. That's a motivating example. So we want to get some kind of statistic where we can take these inter-subject variabilities and cluster them into a population-level activation center. Okay. But before we go on and talk about the modeling, just one quick slide on Bayesian statistics in case some people aren't familiar with it, and just the central difference between the frequentist paradigm and the Bayesian paradigm. And that's how we treat parameters. In the Bayesian paradigm, everything is a random variable. Okay, all the parameters are random. The frequentist paradigm, parameters are considered unknown fixed constants. Okay, and in the Bayesian paradigm, since parameters are constant, we can equip these parameters with a distribution that we call the prior distribution. Okay, and then estimation in the Bayesian paradigm is on the posterior distribution of the parameters given the data. Okay. This probability inversion is performed via Bayes' theorem. So y here represents data, theta is a vector of parameters, and so this would be the likelihood term or a generative distribution. Pi of theta is your prior distribution on the parameters theta, and pi of y is the marginal distribution of y after you integrate out all the parameters. Okay. Now, if this has a nice closed form, like let's say it was multivariate normal, we're done. Okay. We can say anything we want to about this distribution. Typically, though, this integral has a non-closed form. It's analytically intractable, very difficult to estimate numerically, so we resort to Markov chain Monte Carlo simulation techniques. Okay. So the second statistical tool that we're going to use at two different levels in our hierarchy is a finite mixture model. And the best way to motivate that is we suppose there's a population that's made up of several subpopulations. And these subpopulations, if y is a measurement from a subject in subpopulation I, it has distribution fi with a set of parameters theta I. Okay? We also suppose that each subpopulation I is made up of a certain proportion of the total population. We'll call that pi, so that the total proportions sum up to 1. Then a population, this population has a mixture distribution y, which is just the sum of these distributions from each subpopulation multiplied by their proportions. Okay, and we call these distributions fi the mixing components or mixture components, and pi the weights or the mixing proportions. Now, more often than not, when we sample from a population that has a mixture distribution, we don't know which subject belongs to which subpopulation. Okay, so in a Bayesian framework, we'll define a latent allocation variable, zj, for the j subject. And a priori, we say the probability that zj equals k is just the proportion of subjects in that subpopulation. And then conditional on that latent variable, whoops, the j subject has a distribution according to fk theta k. Furthermore, we may not know the number of components, so n may be random as well. And when n's random, the number of parameters varies. Okay, it's called a dimensional parameter space or a transdimensional parameter space. And in order to deal with transdimensional parameter spaces, you can't use Gibbs sampling or Metropolis-Hastings algorithms. There are a few algorithms that have been developed in the past decade. The one we're going to use is called reversible jump Markov chain Monte Carlo. The seminal paper for reversible jump MCMC came out in 1995 in Biometrica, and it's by Peter Green. Okay, and here's just an example of a mixture distribution where the black density here is a mixture of three normal components with probabilities, I think it was 0.2, 0.5, and 0.3. So these aren't densities, these are scaled densities, they're scaled by their mixing proportions. So any place here, the blue, red, and green have to sum up to the black in order for it to be a proper density. And the density here, you integrate over the variable y that has to equal 1. Okay, another central idea we're using in our modeling is a spatial model called the Cox cluster process. And so what we can do is we can assume we're given a set of points yj in space. In our case, it's just going to be an R3. And we assume that they are a realization of a spatial Poisson process with this intensity function. Okay. Here we're using the superposition properties of a Poisson process. Epsilon here, if we didn't have any of these functions h, so n was 0, we just have a homogeneous Poisson process with intensity epsilon. Okay. And that's kind of like the underlying background intensity. These h functions, they're just some non-negative functions. And the interpretation of these is that the points yj that actually belong to one of these functions cluster around some center xi. Okay. So it's a way of clustering, like disease clustering, if you could think of looking for disease clusters of leukemia in Southern California or something like that. You have a baseline intensity rate of leukemia, which was epsilon, and it may follow a homogeneous Poisson process, but there may be clusters of cancers around refineries, oil refineries down near Long Beach, or maybe near a landfill. Okay. The xi's, we can also place a Poisson process on them or a Mark Poisson process. This process xi can also be repulsive, although in everything we do, we're not doing any repulsive processes. As an example, a hardcore process where the density of the xi's would be equal to alpha times some intensity beta raised to the number of points in the process if all the distinct points are greater than some distance r, and it'd be zero otherwise. If r is zero, you just get a Poisson process, and that's what we're going to be using. Okay, so those are some of the ideas of some of the statistical tools we'll be using. Something froze here. Okay, there we go. Just slow. Really slow. Okay, so here's an example of building up this Cox cluster process. If we just start with the homogeneous Poisson process, we just get something that has some flat intensity. In this case, the image was 100 by 100, so I took epsilon to be 0.002. We'd expect on average 20 points from an intensity that looked like this. Then if we add one function, h, it'll center about some point xi, and some of the y's will belong to that. We can add a second function. Maybe the x2 is down here. Okay. As a particular instance of this process, it may look something like this, where the white points come from the homogeneous Poisson process with intensity epsilon. Whoops. The black points cluster around X1 and the magenta colored points cluster around X2. And I don't know why this is happening. I'll just use the button here. Okay? And you can look at this and see that our eyes can pick out clusters here. Say our eyes aren't very good at distinguishing random points in space from actual clusters. So in the modeling, we may once in a while put a cluster point here, but it may not pick those up. Okay, now I wanted to go and do a quick overview of the model. And again, it's a Bayesian spatial hierarchical model. I think before I call it hierarchical spatial, so the adjectives can go wherever you want them to go. Okay, at level one, we're going to model the subject level data. Okay, and the bold statistic image is modeled as a mixture distribution with unknown number of components. Okay, this is kind of a cartoon of three subjects in one slice, where the blue, dark blue background basically means that it's just background and there's no activity there. The larger the higher the red, the darker the red, the more likely that it's active in those regions. Okay, so this is kind of finding these activation regions within subjects. And then the weights in this mixture distribution are going to account for some spatial correlation. And unlike what Du Bois is doing, I'm only considering local correlation, okay? And the correlation will decay over distance, whereas he could find correlations in distinct regions throughout the brain. We're not modeling that at all. So these spatial correlations, the centers of the mixing weights may be at these white X's that I just threw up there. And you know that some of these bigger regions, these bigger activation areas, it can take several components to adequately fit those. Okay. So what we did is we introduced the level two, which is also subject level data, where these component means from level one cluster about activation centers. And again, here we're using a mixture distribution. So these red X's, we're going to consider those as activation centers for these particular activation regions for each subject. Okay. So that's all those modeling we do at the subject level. Then we take all 18 subjects, put them together, all their activation centers, and we take those activation centers and we cluster them about population level centers. And we're going to do this via the spatial Cox cluster process. So, for example, these two black dots are population centers that one draw from the posterior distribution. It's obvious which red X's cluster around the black population centers. And these two green X's, I changed the color, they don't cluster with any other activation centers from any subjects. And so they belong to the background. We call these, I call these, spurious activation centers. Okay, in fMRI analyses, every once in a while, you'll get activation in regions you didn't expect to get activation. It could just be spurious noise, or person was thinking about his girlfriend or something like that. Who knows? During the experiment. Then the last level of the hierarchy is level four, where these population centers, we just equip those with a homogeneous Poisson process. Okay. So that just means conditional on the number of population centers, they're a priori, independent, and identically distributed uniformly throughout the brain. So we're assuming a priori, we don't know where these population centers are. Okay. Now, one beauty about Bayesian analysis is we did it IID uniformly, but if you know where you're expected to find these population centers, you can put higher prior probability in those areas, okay, to help drive the model. But here we just did it IID. Okay, let's go to the model details. Level one, got the data. This YIJ, this is the bold statistic image for subject I voxel J. Okay, Du Bois was using beta, I'm using Y here. Okay, given all other parameters as a mixture distribution. We separated out background from the other ones because we're going to treat the weight for the background slightly differently. So the weights come, the background, if it comes from background, it's normal with mean theta 0 and some variance. And then we have CI, where CI is an unknown number of activation regions. Okay, and theta IL here would be the mean act of bold signal in a particular region in the brain. Okay, the local spatial correlations accounted for in the mixing weights. So we specify our mixing weights. This is the mixing weight for subject I, voxel J, for the ELF component. It's going to be equal to a constant Q if L is 0. So that's for the background. And we'll explain on the next slide a little bit more about that. Otherwise, the mixing weight is going to be proportional to a trivariate normal density, or multivariate normal density, with mean eta IL and covariance matrix psi IL. And of course, the weights have to sum to 1. Okay. This eta IL is the location mean of component L subject I. So those are those white X's I showed in that cartoon a few slides ago. Okay. What I didn't show in the slide was the covariance around those particular components. And of course, we don't know which, if voxel J for subject I, which component it belongs to a priori, so we define latent allocation variables Wij, such that the probability of Wij equaling L is just the weight PijL. Okay. I'm going to go through the model for each level and then the priors, so because there's a lot of 4 levels in this hierarchy, there's a lot of priors and parameters here. So the mean intensity for background follows a normal 1 distribution. The precision for the background follows a diffuse gamma. Okay, so we don't know much about it. We're going to have a lot of data in the background, so we can use something diffuse there. For the mean intensities for each of the components, we're going to assume it comes from a normal distribution with a mean of 3.92 and a variance of 1. And I got this 3.92 because these two densities intersect at the 0.975 quantile of a normal distribution, standard normal distribution. We specify the variance for these components, or the precision of these components, hierarchically, so we give it a gamma, alpha equals 3, and a beta, and then beta is a diffuse gamma, okay? And this does 2 things. The first thing it does is it gives you random effects for these components. You expect these components with high intensity to be similar but not identical. The second thing it does is it removes some of the dependence on the posterior on this prior and moves it more towards the data, okay? We've inflated the variance here. Instead of just giving this a gamma 3, 1, we let beta have some variability as well. Okay. This was an experiment, a psychological experiment. These experiments are typically designed so only a small portion of the brain activates. Okay. So Q, which was that number for the mixing proportion for background, we set to 39. Okay. And this controls the number of activated sites, along with the precision parameter psi for the mixing weights for the activated regions. This is a Wishart, 10 degrees of freedom, and a scale matrix that's diagonal is 0.2 pi on the diagonal. Okay. Now, these two together result in an a priori probability of 0.975 that any particular site, xij is just a particular voxel, it's xyz, coordinates for subject I, voxel J. 95.975 probability that belongs to background when this particular voxel is coincident with a component mean and all other component means are far away. Okay? So that means that all the other component means basically have a probability of 0 that that particular voxel belongs to those components. Okay? So then you basically have Q equals 39, and then the normal density would be 1 for belonging to the center, so 39 over 40 is 0.975. If you set Q to 9, you get a probability of 90%. If it was 4, it would be 80%. If it's 99, it would be 99%. So by setting this precision matrix this way, we can change Q to control basically this prior probability. The number of mixing components is a parameter. We don't know the number, so we have to put a prior on that. We just give it a prior uniform distribution over the integers from 1 to 200. And that was kind of set empirically. Roughly, the number of components is anywhere, in our example, from 5 to 50. So it's plenty big enough range. And then again, reversible jump is used to estimate the number of these mixture components. Okay, so now we've taken the bold statistic images, found regions of high activation, and put these mixture components around them that have spatial information in them. Now on level 2, this was admittedly kind of an afterthought. We had expected one mixture component per activation site or region, but some of these things are pretty big regions of activation and it takes several components to fit them. We only wanted one activation center per activation region. So we put in this second level where we took the component means from level 1 and distributed them about activation centers. Okay, these activation centers were those red X's in the cartoon. And so eta IL were the component means, and they're just given this mixture density. Okay, QIK is the mixing proportion, and then this whole term here, that's just a truncated normal distribution. And we're truncating it because we don't want these activation, these components or the activation centers to fall outside of the brain region. So B sub I is the region of the I subject's brain. Okay, so it can't go outside of that region. So we use truncated normals. And again, we have latent allocation variables because we don't know a priori which of these component means cluster about which activation centers. Okay. At this point, you might also note that the component means, eta, and the activation centers nu are latent variables as well. We don't observe them. All we observe is the bold statistic image. Okay, so level 2 priors. For our vector of allocation variables, we just give it a Dirichlet prior, which is uniform, so we give it ones. The precision matrix phi is given a Wishart with 5 degrees of freedom and some scale matrix, and this is hierarchically modeled here as well. Instead of trying to go through all this, what this does, it results a priori in the expected value of the covariance matrix equaling S, which is an isotropic Gaussian density, full width half max of about 0.94 centimeters, or a priori it has a 95% credible sphere of about 1 centimeter radius. Okay, because we don't expect, this has to be a fairly informative prior because you don't want things in the left lateral prefrontal cortex clustering with activation centers in the right prefrontal cortex. So if you take too big of a covariance matrix here, you're going to be clustering points in different regions of the brain that shouldn't be clustering with each other. Again, the number B sub I of these mixture components is given a uniform distribution over a set of integers, and reversible jumps used to estimate those as well. Okay, so that's all the subject modeling we do. Now we're going to take these activation centers and put them all together and look for population centers. So these individual activation centers, we're going to cluster about population activation centers via the spatial Cox cluster process. Okay? And the intensity function is given by this expression. Now, in the cartoon, H was just some arbitrary non-negative function. Here, it's going to be some parameter theta multiplied by a truncated normal density. Okay, three-dimensional truncated normal density. One of the properties of a Poisson process, because this is just the intensity of a Poisson process, is that conditional on the total number of individual activation centers, their locations are IID uniform over the volume of the brain. Okay, so we don't assume any prior information about where these things belong. But again, in a Bayesian framework, you can specify that you have higher probability that you're going to find things in the left lateral prefrontal cortex. Okay, level three priors for the homogeneous intensity epsilon. We give it a gamma distribution with parameters 54 and then the volume of the brain. This results in expected number of spurious activation sites to be 54. And NS, denotes the number of spurious individual activation centers. And that works out, since there are 18 subjects in this analysis, it works out to approximately 3 spurious activation centers per individual. So we don't expect too many of these per individual. Okay, and these are numbers you can play with. If you expect more or less, you can adjust this. We place a hyper prior distribution on epsilon just to reflect our uncertainty in the expected number. Okay, we could have just said it's 54. But it's we give it a little bit... 54 divided by the volume of the brain. But we weren't certain, so we gave it a little bit of uncertainty. For theta, we gave it a gamma 9-1 distribution. This interpretation of theta you can think of it as the expected number of individual activation centers that you expect to cluster around each one of these population centers. Okay, we chose that to have a mean of 9, which is about half of the subjects. Okay, we don't expect all the subjects to show activation, at least in this study, in that region, or in any other regions that may cluster. Okay. If I go back here for a minute. So the H function now, it isn't just parameterized by the locations, Xi. Xi now is a marked Poisson process with locations mu I and then these covariances sigma I as marks. Okay, so it's a marked homogeneous Poisson process with intensity lambda. Mu I is a homogeneous Poisson process with marks sigma I. That's all it means to be a marked Poisson process, or homogeneous Poisson process. Lambda is the expected number of population centers. We just gave it 10. And then we have more hyperprior distributions on the marked sigma I. And they just result in a priori expected value of sigma I to be 6.25 along the diagonals, or a full width half max of about 1.18 centimeter. Okay, and these points mu I are simulated via the spatial birth-death process. Don't have time to go into that, but basically you can find this from Van Lieshout and Badley 2002 in a book called Spatial Cluster Modeling, and it's in chapter 4. Okay, let's look at some results. Excuse me. First, I'm going to look at the marginal or the posterior marginal intensity of the individual centers. Okay. Now, this data set was 79 by 95 by 69 slices. It's hard to go through all 69 slices. So I marginalized over each dimension of the brain. Okay. These expected values, this is the expected number of total activation centers over all individuals. And there were a total of about, average 97.7. NS is the number of spurious activation centers that didn't cluster with any other activation centers, and there were about 62 of those. Okay. You can see that the highest intensity turned out to be in the left lateral prefrontal cortex, where they expected it to be. Looks like there might be something going on bilaterally as well. And then there's some other stuff along the midline. I'm not sure what it is. These results I just came up with in the last week or so. So this part of the talk differs a little bit than what was in the abstract. And I haven't had time to talk with Derek Nee, the psychologist who gave us this data, and what these other things, how to interpret these other activation regions. Okay, so now the second slide of results are the posterior marginal intensity of the population centers. Okay, and the expected number of population centers was 5.2 over the entire brain. And you can see that we've separated out, you can variability between the individual centers as they cluster about populations, and then the uncertainty in the population center locations. Now these are intensity functions, they're not densities, but the intensity and density are proportional to one another. Okay, so you can kind of think of this as intensity or a density, but this would scale differently. Okay, so something's definitely going on in the left lateral prefrontal cortex. Now the next slide I'm going to show is just a cross section. I'm going to show the axial slice of the cross section that goes through about this point, and that's at slice 40. So that's pretty much through the left lateral prefrontal cortex, where we expect to find the most amount of activation or intensity. Okay, this is the posterior individual center intensity and the population level intensity. And again, you can see there's more variability about the individual center intensity. There's some stuff down back here, maybe in the occipital lobe. You really can't see anything here. And it's there, it's just it's hidden in this color scale. So what I did is instead of a linear color scale, I made a nonlinear color scale. So you can just see that there is actual population level things here that correlate with where the individual activation regions cluster about. Okay. So it's just a shift in the scale. With these intensity functions, if you integrate over the whole brain of the population intensity function, you get 5.2 on average. We can take any volume or any Borel set within the brain and integrate over that to find the expected number of population centers within that region. And so I did that in a 1 cm³ centered at these two points, which is approximately right here, and then over here on the other side, and we get an expected number of population centers of 0.799 over here and 0.136 here. So there's much stronger evidence in the left lateral prefrontal cortex of something going on. And if I made this cube a little bit larger, it does end up going to 1, because if you make this as large as the brain, you're going to get 5.2. Okay, one other thing the investigators were interested in, and Tom, my co-author, was interested in, was for each place that we ever saw a population center in the posterior, what is the population prevalence? How many subjects had activation centers that clustered around that population center? Okay, so this is a little hard to interpret, but let's focus on this point up here that's away from everybody else. In the posterior of the population intensity, at one iteration, or at one point in the posterior, we found a population center here. Okay, and the light blue means that when we had a population center there, on average, about 0.2 of the 18 subjects clustered about that population center. Okay, so if we look at here, where the population intensity is the highest in the left lateral prefrontal cortex, around that region, it's mostly yellow, and it was about somewhere between 0.33 and 0.4. So on average, only about 6 or 7 of the 18 subjects had any activation clustering around that particular population level center. And that may be another reason why the mass univariate approach didn't give any statistically significant results, because only about a third of the subjects had activation during this experiment in this left lateral prefrontal cortex. In the right lateral prefrontal cortex, you can see the proportions a little bit lower, somewhere between 2 and 3, or about 4 to 5 subjects. Okay. So in conclusion, using this spatial Cox cluster model, it can be used to quantify the location and the spread of the population centers. It can also be used to quantify the spread of the individual activation centers around population centers. Okay, so we've separated out those two sources of variability. It ignores activation centers that don't cluster with any other activation centers. That's the underlying homogeneous baseline intensity. So we call those spurious activation sites. Also, it doesn't rely on overlap of individual activation regions. So this is not a voxel level analysis. Okay, we don't need to do a lot of smoothing to get those regions to overlap. Okay, and again, I want to point out that we aren't separately modeling intersubject variability and variability due to misalignment. We're treating that as the same variability, although it probably could be parcelated out if you had an idea of the amount of misregistration in your data. Okay, and we can also easily incorporate other relevant prior information, like Du Bois showed you some of those maps of the brains that have the different regions. You could take that information in that map and not allow activation centers from one region and another region to cluster with the same population, within the same population center. Okay, so there's a lot of more room of flexibility and a lot more we can do with this model. And finally, I'd like to thank my collaborators. A lot of this work was based on a former student of Tom Nichols and mine, Lei Xu. She's now at Vanderbilt. Tom Nichols used to be a colleague of mine at Michigan. He's now at GlaxoSmithKline in the University of Oxford. And Derek Nee was a psychology PhD student who recently moved to Indiana University. Thank you.
Very nice. Do we have questions?
Yeah. In the other, you mean in the finite mixture model parts?
Yeah.
But I don't, no. Not in those areas, because I don't think you can do it. Because we can talk about it later, but I don't think it's possible. We did do it at the last level where I used the spatial Cox cluster model. We used a finite mixture model and a Dirichlet process model. And here's the thing that I didn't think I had time to talk about. When you use that model, every single activation level has to cluster with around some population level. And so it makes it very hard to start interpreting population level centers, because what I saw when I did this thing in the full 3D volume is that you always ended up with a population center right smack in the middle of the brain. And the variance enveloped the whole brain. Okay? I thought, you know, this isn't right. These things shouldn't be clustering. Okay? This epsilon in the Cox cluster process model, that baseline homogeneous Poisson process, takes care of that, and it doesn't cluster those. So, yeah. Good question.
Keith.
Oh.
Keith, have a question. I have a question about the way you summarize individual subject spatial maps. So, ultimately, what is fed up to the multi-subject analysis is a parameterized simplification of the spatial extent of the individual subject clusters.
Right.
Is that correct?
Just the centers of the components move up.
Right. Just the centers, not the extent or...
Right.
And so could you comment on your experience on whether that's a sufficiently rich description of the individual subject spatial extent?
So the spatial extent is modeled at level one. Okay. We can either look at the posterior predictive density of the bold statistic image, and you'll get clusters of voxels that are highly activated. And for each one of those voxels, we can assign a probability that it belongs to background or activation center. So you can look at a probability map and see all these, you know, regions that cluster. But some of those voxels within our model are going to be going in and out of activation centers and in and out of background. So the centers are going to be moving. Okay. And since we're doing this with MCMC, at each draw of the MCMC, the activation centers can move a little bit, the variances can change, and so you do get that variability included. But we do model voxel by voxel whether or not, you know, we can attach a probability that's greater than 0.8 and then have a threshold
so
map.
At that level, but how much of that spatial information is carried up to what ultimately is the most important analysis, the cross-subject analysis?
Pretty much the center and the variability of the center, yeah, that's all.
So do you think, is it often the case, do you think, that individual subject activation shapes would need more information about the shape and extent of the activation to be used at the highest level?
I don't think so. I mean, if somebody's activation region was 2 cubic centimeters and somebody else only had 0.5 cubic centimeters, I don't think you want to bias the results towards the person who used more of their brain. Personally, I think that it should be just the centers that go up to the population level. Otherwise, you're going to be, you could be biasing it towards those people who have show larger activation regions.
JP.
It is, yeah.
I think I would agree. I mean, if you don't tune the data, there's very little chance that, it's going to be enough for, at the subject level to describe your activation, and I would really agree with that. I think it was a very nice model. It's very close to, some of the work we've been doing, and it's, I think the issue is really important. I mean, we emphasize that probably tomorrow, but I was wondering, in your model, have you tried to, there's quite a lot of parameters, and the
right.
Important thing, of course, is that the results are not too dependent or sensitive to those parameters. Have you tried to run some of those,
we've done.
Can you summarize the question?
So the question is, I have a lot of parameters in this model, and a lot of prior information goes into the model. I think essentially he's asking, have we done sensitivity analyses and change priors? Yeah, we've done a lot of sensitivity analysis. And at the individual level, that Q modeled the proportion of voxels that actually, or control the proportion of voxels that were either activated or not activated, that makes a big difference at the individual level, because you can change that and you can get huge activation regions that probably don't make sense because they're spanning, huge parts of the brain. But that can go ahead and give you more activation centers, and so that can carry on. You may get different numbers of population centers that, if I were to drop Q to 19 instead of 39, we may have seen 6 or 7 population centers. So there is some sensitivity. Yeah.
I've got another question on the computational time. I mean, reversible jumps are well known to be extremely slow to converge and quite sensitive to. There's a few issues on those.
So the 18 subjects, on average, there were about 275,000 voxels each. The hardest part is in the first level. We have to compute that full mixture likelihood at each voxel. But we got it down doing some computer science tricks and a few other things to about 21 hours CPU time to run the whole thing, about 40,000 iterations. So it's slower than DuBois's, but I also have to compute a likelihood at over almost 300,000 voxels per subject at each iteration. So that takes a lot of time. You're doing a lot of exponentials or logs in there, depending on which.
So when you went, sensitivity
analysis. Well, the sensitivity analysis, yeah, we ran a few of those, but I have a cluster of 4 machines with 4 processors in it, so you can do a lot of work at once, right?
So in some situations, an alternative to reversible jump, where effectively you're comparing different models, in your case, different numbers of sensors, would it be possible to use less hardcore but more computationally advantageous approach, such as automatic relevance determination, to turn clusters off?
Yeah, you could probably do that instead of reversible jump.
Would that be? Is there any reason why that would be an oversimplistic approach, do you think?
I'd have to actually write down the model and think about it a little bit, or the algorithm. I don't think it'd be oversimplistic. One thing that I did do for the likelihood in 30 seconds is that most of the brain is background and only a little bit activated. So why compute that mixture distribution, the density for that mixture distribution, at a background point that has virtually probability of one belonging to background? So at each iteration, I compute the Mahalanobis distance from the center of those the mixture components. And if it's farther away than 5 or 6 standard deviation units, I don't bother computing the contribution to the likelihood from that term. Okay, and I did some empirical estimation on the error in my likelihood, and it was about on the order of 10 to the minus 7th was the largest error I got. So yeah, you can do some tricks like that to really reduce the amount of computation. If the probability belonging to background is 9 times 10 to the minus, or 9 times 10 to the 10th or something like that, why compute all those other normal densities at that point? So I think that's a similar type of a thing as the ARD, you call it?
Not really, but...
I know what you mean. You have a latent variable to turn it on or off. Yeah,
exactly.
Which, then you have even more parameters, because you have many more parameters than you do data points.
Well, this would be on the clusters, I think, not the individual voxels. So you could turn the clusters on at the higher level.
You know, there's so few of those. If I didn't have to compute that density at each voxel, that's about 80% of the work.
Okay.
So it'd be much faster without that, yeah.
Okay, we'll take a 5-minute break and then come back. Thank you.